I would like to welcome you here tonight. Many years have passed since we've seen each other. Some of you may know my eyesight has grown progressively worse, and although I cannot see you, I feel your presence. I will begin tonight's lecture by refreshing your memory regarding some basic art historical facts, facts that you now realize are the basis for the conspiracy that continues to plague us. Let us begin with the summer of 1973 in Amarillo, Texas, with the death of Robert Smithson, the American sculptor. In recalling that period, most of us had no reason to believe the circumstances were anything but accidental. The aircraft simply lost control. Their motor failed. He died. There were no suspicions. 4 years later, on July 12, 1977, 60 miles south of Las Vegas, Nevada, Walter De Maria committed suicide. He was preparing the final details concerning the installation of his lightning rod project in the desert. The art community was shocked, but the investigation uncovered no circumstances that could be considered abnormal. I became suspicious on September 11th, 1977, 4 years after Robert Smithson's death. Michael Heitzer, the American earth artist, was found trampled to death outside his trailer east of Reno, Nevada. As far as I was concerned, my suspicions were justified. All three of these artists worked within a similar sensibility, that of large, land-based projects. The coincidence was overwhelming. The art community became slightly edgy. This discomfort broke into mild hysteria when on January 15, 1979, a Boeing 747 en route to Copenhagen exploded off the coast of Sweden. All the passengers were killed. On board were Carl Andre, Robert Morris, Bruce Nauman, Lawrence Wiener, Joseph Kossuth, Robert Barry, and William Wegman. Bomb fragments were discovered within the wreckage, and the reports termed the situation bizarre. Apparently, the placement of the bomb in proximity of the passengers created rather unusual after effects. It was now overwhelmingly obvious that we were in the midst of a conspiracy. American artists who had surfaced during the 60s were the target of a carefully planned series of assassinations, beginning in 1973 with the death of Robert Smithson. I've always believed this, although with Smithson's death I had no direct clues. Meanwhile, I began preparing myself for what I felt would be the slow and complete annihilation of the American avant-garde. A methodical master plan spread over perhaps 20 years, but successfully wiping out the backbone of American art. My first performance project using a marionette as a stand-in was tested in 1973. Many felt this was just another extension of myself, similar to the performance projects in which I involved my children in activities which spread or passed on my actions. However, behind the early performance figures was a mounting paranoia that shortly, if I remained surfaced, I too would become a victim of assassination. I was not able to detect any theme or consistent patterns in the deaths of the early victims, Smithson, De Maria, Heitzer, outside of the obvious relationship of their work. I did, however, after the plane crash over Sweden in 1979, notice underlying abstract connections that are often found in the methodology or logic used in art making. On September 19th, 1980, 8 months after the crash of the Boeing 747, Vito Acconci fell down an open elevator shaft of his mother's apartment building in the South Bronx. Because of my close relationship with Akanchi, I was notified immediately of this tragedy and did, in fact, rush to the Bronx. It was then that I knew my suspicions were warranted. There was an artist behind these acts. The individual acts were facets within an evolving larger work. Akanchi's body lay in the basement of the tenement building. He had dropped 14 floors. There were spears of intersecting light patterns jabbing into his body from the cracks in the basement ceiling. They produced an almost perfect grid over the body, containing it in 6 squares. God knows how a body lands after a fall almost 200 feet. But I have never seen a position like this. He was completely rigid. His right side pressed into the soft earth of the shaft's floor, showing only the left side. He looked more as if he had risen from the ground than fallen from a great distance. His body was magically integrated within the space. As the authorities pulled Akanchi from his tomb of intersecting light patterns, the imprint of his body appeared. It seemed more related to art than to death. For the next few months, I immersed myself in the examination of facts and details pertaining to what now amounted to the death of 11 artists, all of which occurred between 1973 and 1980. I was not alone in my interrogation of these actions. I remember only too clearly back in 1970, 20 years ago, speculating on the art of the 80s, feeling out the sensations of my own development, testing hypothetically the duration of particular sensibilities in terms of change. The 80s always appeared dark and mysterious somehow. The rhythm in my own work did not make the sufficient leap to afford a perspective into the future. When the 80s came upon us with Akanchi's death, the new art suddenly showed itself. In some way, our individual objectives gave way to a union of investigation. Our work became an instrument to combat what seemed to be happening to us. The 80s bred the art of survival. Artists became investigators. The purpose of the American avant-garde was to break the code, trace the connections, feel out the rhythms, and shed light on what seemed to be an untranslatable aesthetic master plan set into motion by presumably an artist. As victims continued to fall during the winter of 1981, Robert Ryman and Keith Saunier were taken within the same week, the better galleries began to close. Their attempts to absorb new artists to replace the growing number of assassination victims failed. Mediocrity prevailed in most of the art community. Critical writing focused on the more lightweight developments for fear of implication or association with the aesthetics of possible victims of assassination. My new projects continued with surrogate performances. The inclusion of an audio system built into the figure started in the mid-70s. This device allowed me to inject live voices into the figures from offstage. These indirect performances became less frequent because the risk of even being in close proximity to the work was too great. All the strong dance companies of the late 60s were wiped out. Yvonne Rainer, Joan Jonas, and Trisha Brown died during their performances. Musicians such as Phil Glass and Steve Reich went into hiding, but reports suggest that Glass had been the victim of a head-on collision in the south of France. There had been no news of Steve Reich in 15 years. Of course, I too went into hiding. The South Houston area of New York became a barren landscape of foreclosed buildings. Some commercial industries moved into the area in an attempt to save it from complete deterioration, but generally, it was known as New York's ghost town, like a stage set. It was no longer real. Landlords defaulted. Squatters began to occupy most of the buildings on West Broadway, such as 420, which became the home of heroin addicts. Only two galleries remained in that area throughout this period, but needless to say, the caliber of work they exhibited bordered on department store art, and its proprietors had no way of relating to any sense of recent art history. Meetings of artists, which proliferated during the 70s in an attempt to confront this wave of what became known as aesthetics of assassination, came to a halt when an entire room full of panelists and the audience were machine guns, Chicago style, leaving only three members of the underground alive. Even that seemingly classical method of execution had the constituents of a performance or some considered art activity. One survivor spoke of bursts of machine gun fire projected from four corners. The type of cartridge used was a tracer shell, which produces traces of the trajectory, causing, during the peak volley, a perfect dissection of the room from corner to corner. On November 16, 1987, an attempt was made on my life. It was only due to bizarre circumstances that I escaped only wounded. This was not uncommon. Several artists escaped assassination during this period. Never at any point were there any clues left leading to suspects. Somehow, even though the grand scale and exactness of these acts suggested an army, or at least a well-organized group, the inside feeling, that is, the feeling of the remaining victims, was that these acts were produced by one person.
Starting with the 70s, I did a series of what were called Mott Art hearings. And the way they work, just so for the benefit of those sitting out there, is that I ask somebody from the audience to come up and talk to me. They can speak about anything they want to. I am restricted to asking them only about what they have spoken about. I cannot introduce any subjects. They must be the one to introduce the subjects. After a while, when the person feels they've said what they want to say, they leave the table and someone else from the audience comes up and takes this chair. And so if you have a question or a thought, you must give it from this chair, not from the audience. Do you want to make a statement, Tom?
Hi, Les. Well, I want to make a lot of statements. Hello to all of you. Did you all know Dennis? No. I think it's a sad occasion. I mean, but you know, I miss Dennis personally. He was a dear friend in my life. But there was something that I came here tonight, today, thinking that I would say it. It's going to take a minute, but we're here today, technically, I think we're supposed to be here in commemoration of Dennis's piece, lecture number one, 1976, which has these four rows of 12 chairs. Both 4 and 12 are numbers of totality, and I guess that's what he had in mind. This is a book I wrote about Dennis a long time ago when I first met him. We met in, I think it was about 1982 or 3, on the occasion of that PS1 wanted to put this book out. Now, you see, I'm looking for my glasses. Well, okay. Uh,
Perhaps I should ask you a question.
Well, give me a minute. Okay. When I met Dennis, I was writing this thing about him. And even though he was such a great and famous artist, one of the things that is special about him is that somehow he remained kind of in the outlaw position, even though he was very totally respected and accepted, and he was a canonical artist. I mean, his name, it was clear his name was going to be in all the art history books of his era. And when I met him in 1982, now I'm not sure about the dates of what I'm going to say. I'm going to say something about the overall shape of Dennis's career or his oeuvre as an artist. I guess everyone has heard about the fact that Dennis's, I'm being simplistic, please don't be offended, but Dennis's career, his oeuvre as an artist, tended to break into two parts. There was the early work, starting in 1967, with site markers and viewing platform. You see, these were intensely theoretical works. Dennis was reversing the way that the art experience happens. I mean, viewing platform is a platform from which to view a work of art. In other words, it's not a work of art. It's a platform from which to view a work of art. So what I'm saying is that Dennis made the viewing and the reception of art the work of art. Now, this is the kind of thing that was happening in 1966, 67, and 68. And Dennis was right there in the forefront with a bunch of other people, like the half dozen or so artists who were showing at the Dwan Gallery. And they really reversed the meaning of the theory of art. They really did. This happened in the late 60s and 70s. And at the time, it seemed truly revolutionary. And this is what I mean. When I first talked with Dennis about this in about 1983, what came out was that during the period when he was doing these early theoretical works, and other artists like, say, Michael Heiser, Robert Smithson, and lots of, you all know their names, they were also doing this work that reversed the theory of art. And this was the whole point of art at the moment. And as Dennis and I, in around 1983, sat and talked about these things, I suggested to him that he and his contemporary artists of that group, who completely reversed the whole theory of art in these years, 1967 and 1968, it happened like that. You know, and it was all turned around. And Dennis said that, well, here's the point that I've been leading up to. I'm sorry I've been so slow to get to it. But he felt that something had ended. That's what this piece is about, lecture number one, 1976, with the four rows of 12 chairs and so on. It was about the idea, you know, that the avant-garde has ended. If I could find those glasses.
He does refer to the avant-garde in 1987 again. Yeah. So why do you think he does that?
I'm not sure. Anthony, yes?
Yeah.
Oh, well, thanks. They're going to work? Thank you very much. Well, that's wonderful. Well, that's great. Yeah, they do work. See, Dennis told me that around 1980, there was a hiatus in his career in terms of exhibitions. around 1980, I mean, I don't want to overstate this, and Amy, I know you were there, but around 1980, Dennis began to feel that the meaning which he and his contemporaries had been pursuing when they reversed the theory of art, that meaning had become empty. You know, it was in the early 80s, starting around 1980 to 1982, that what we call postmodernism dawned in the world of contemporary art. It had started earlier in certain other fields, but that was when it happened in the field of contemporary art, and Dennis felt it intensely because he knew that what he had been doing when, at that time, those crucial years, 66, 67, 68, when they reversed the theory of art or turned it inside out, if you see what I mean, they had felt that history was about to go over the top, if you see what I mean. The Hegelian view of history was that history has this principle of progress inherent inside it, and that history is acting out a drama of progress, and Dennis and other artists of the generation that I'm talking about all felt that they were carrying history. They were important people because they were carrying history up to its moment of reversal. And they were presiding over this great moment of the reversal of the meaning of history. And Dennis, at the time, like 1981, 82, I'm not sure I have the dates right, but anyway, he told me that there was a hiatus in his career. He didn't show work for 2 or 3 years. And as a matter of fact, now I don't want to get too gossipy about this, but he told me that he was very depressed for a couple of years, and that he stopped exhibiting work and spent a lot of time in solitude reading some of the basic texts of postmodernism that were coming out, like Baudrillard and so on. During this period, Dennis realized that the idea that he and his colleagues, like Michael Heiser, had put history over the top, so it had become that much closer to the Hegelian culmination. And he suddenly realized, as everybody did at that time, that had lost meaning completely. This is what is known as the transition from modernism to postmodernism. And this work about lecture number one, Dennis says that the avant-garde is ending. And that is exactly what happened. Now, he said that in 1967, and 1976, and actually it was 3 or 4 years later that it happened. He foresaw it in that way. And when it happened, he realized that it meant that his early work had lost meaning, that in a sense it had been meaningless all along. And he entered this period of solitude and depression and thoughtfulness. And then around 1983 or 84, he started coming out of it again and exhibiting work again. Now, I remember I was at a show, an opening of Dennis's work at the space, which used to be called Metro Pictures. I don't know what it's called now, but anyway, Dennis had some work in there, and it was kind of dark, and he saw some dust on the floor, and somewhere, he disappeared for a minute, and somewhere he got a broom, and he came out, and he was sweeping floor around the installation of his sculpture, and then he came over to me, and he was laughing and saying, "These young people here but probably amazed at seeing this fossil." He called himself a fossil, meaning that his early work, his meaningful work, was from an earlier era. He was a fossil of an earlier era out there sweeping the floor. And then, this is the point I really want to make, is that around 1983 or 84, he turned his own mind around, and this is what's referred to as the transition from modernism to postmodernism. And that's what this work, lecture number one, is about. Dennis says the avant-garde is ending, which means that modernism is ending, which in a sense means that history is ending. History in the Hegelian sense of the culmination. And after two or three years of solitude and thoughtfulness and quiet, he began to show work again, the fossil out there sweeping the floor, sweeping the dust off of his work. And he entered a new phase. This is the second part of his career, when it was like suddenly he found himself in a new, really fun world of reindeer and mice, if you can remember his work of that period. And in other words, what I'm saying is this. Dennis was one of the crucial artists of late modernism who turned around the whole meaning of art and art theory. And then he and everybody lost faith in what they had done. So what was he going to do? Was he going to die? Was he going to go into the basement and stay there, or what? Well, he didn't. He experienced a rebirth, and in around 1984, he started exhibiting new work that was completely unlike his earlier work, and he again became an important artist. Now, I know I'm dragging this out, but my point is that a lot of artists who had really felt the meaning of their work in the 60s and 70s were lost in the 80s. The 80s was when postmodernism hit the world of contemporary art, around 1982. And Dennis, at this point, became depressed and secretive and thought about it all. And then he came out of hiding and he entered on a new brilliant career that had a completely different meaning. I'm presenting this as the essence of Dennis's view of the art of survival, which is what we're supposed to be here to talk about tonight, is Dennis's view of the art of survival.
Can I ask you a question?
You can in just a second. So that my point is that Dennis experienced... Dennis experienced the failure of history, and then he came out of the failure of history, and he didn't need history anymore. And he made a new series of brilliant works that we all know and love that involve a sense of the fun in life more than the serious meaning of life, which is what the first era was about. Okay, Les, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. No. It's reasonable to assume that as you said, that the avant-garde ended about 1986. Do you have any view why that happened?
There's several conventional views about it, which I think all have meaning, like, above all, the market. I mean, when these brilliant young artists, like Dennis and Robert Smithson and Michael Heiser and et cetera, when they reversed the meaning of art and the theory of art, it was like, well, of course, when Dennis says in the little text, which was just read to us, about lecture number one, that the avant-garde is about to end. And he was right, and painting was about to come back, and he was right,
Do you think there's any... What do you think about the idea that it is presented in the idea of sort of a melodrama. What do you think about that?
Number six. You mean I'm presenting it as a melodrama?
No, not you.
No. Because I am.
The lecture is presented in the form of a melodrama.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? I mean, does that give you any indication into the psychology at all?
I like the question. I knew Dennis personally pretty well. We were about the same age. Actually, he was 1 year older than me. And when we met each other at the time that he asked me to write this book, and Alana Hayek said, you know, this is the, one of the things that I meant to say is that it's fantastic and unbelievable that this great famous artist never had a retrospective exhibition at a major New York museum. He never did. This is the, you know, Dennis somehow managed to be this tremendously successful, highly regarded, accepted artist and an outlaw. He managed to somehow do them both, which I always admired about him greatly. Because I don't want to get gossipy again. Back to you.
Yeah. Well, okay. So there's a certain selection of artists here.
Yeah.
They don't encompass the entire avant-garde by any means.
Yeah.
What do you think they encompass?
When you say there's a certain number of artists here.
Well, certain names of artists, let's say. Included here. Well, there are many other artists working at the time that could have been considered, at the forefront of art.
Well, yeah, it had a lot to do with, the gallery. I mean, like the Virginia Dwan Gallery was tremendously important in what seemed to be the avant-garde of the late '60s, and. What's your question, Les?
My question is, does the selection of the particular set of artists here indicate anything specific to you?
Well, what it indicates to me, you see, I believe the art historical view that this group of brilliant young artists did really reverse the theory and meaning of art. I believe it completely. That's one of the things that brought me into the world of art. I wouldn't have, frankly, been interested in it if it had just been a matter of people making pretty objects. I thought that was an answer.
It was. Could you, Tom? Do you think you could speak directly to me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, because I did want to include them in it. That's why I turned
included.
My chair.
They are included. Yeah. They are included. They could see us both. Yeah. They are included. Okay. So one can make the assumption then from this. That this is sort of like the subtext of all this is that the avant-garde is being wiped out.
It was wiped out.
Was wiped out. And you're saying it was replaced by postmodernism?
Well, yeah. And if you think about, if you're familiar with Dennis's work, and you think about the early works starting in 67 with site markers and viewing platform, and then you think about the work that started to come out in 85. It's really, really different. This is what I'm talking. This is why I bring all this up to address the issue of the art of survival, which was Dennis's idea. And I think that he exhibited the art of.
He was one of the
late modernist artists that had the floor pulled out from under them when modernism ended. And he came back. He survived. He came back and had a brilliant career, a brilliant second career, as a postmodern artist. Okay.
Okay, well, I'm not... Okay, in what sense was he a modernist?
Well,
given the understanding that we think about modernism as being, you know, Picasso and all those kind of people, yeah. Who, in what sense was he a modernist?
Well, I said late modern. See, late modern is really different. It's really special. I mean, late modernism was an enormously important 10 years or so. Dennis came in on toward the end of it. Go on, Les.
Well, if I think about late modernism, I think about people like Ed Reinhardt and those kind of people.
Or Rothko, right,
yeah,
right.
Those kind of people. Dennis never made any work that looked like that.
No. But at the very end of late modernism, there was this group of artists, I keep coming back to this, who believed that they were being carried along by history, that history was a force that was carrying them along toward a culmination. And Dennis was involved in that. And he and I talked about this lots of times, and he did say that when he felt that that had ended, he kind of went into hiding for a couple of years and thought things over. And then when he came back with the aura, the brilliant aura of survival around him, yes.
Okay, survival. And that's an interesting word. You know, in what sense do you mean the word survival? Just living day to day? Just surviving as an artist? What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean the meaning of it. Like, what I'm saying is that in the early period of Dennis's work, the late 60s and the 70s, starting in, I think, 67, that his work was deeply theoretical. And then the values on which the theory had been based lost credibility. And he and other artists, other great artists of his generation, had the floor pulled out from under them. Now, a lot of them just simply stopped making art because they felt that what they had been doing had a kind of ultimate reality, and now that the floor had been pulled out from under it, there was no point in doing anything else because the ultimate reality was already over. I mean, like Walter de Maria. I mean, like he stopped making work, I think. I mean, maybe I just don't know. But anyway, Dennis did something that none of the others did. He came back as a different kind of artist. When the theory that he had been working on disappeared, he fell into he fell into a thoughtful and sad period of a couple of years in the basement reading Baudrillard and realizing that the meaning of his early work was all over. And then he could have just, like, say, Walter de Maria. I mean,
Walter's still making work.
But let me finish my sentence. Like, Dennis is the only one who came back with a new body of work that was really different and that really did embody and promote the new era that was coming in. In other words, Dennis, what I'm saying is Dennis was involved in bringing in the era of the late 60s and 70s, and again, he was involved in bringing in the era of the 80s and 90s. And that's what, that's survival.
Okay. Okay. Do you think there's any, the idea, let's say, that, let's get back to this for a second. The idea that somebody is thinking in terms of people, let's say, not being artists anymore as a means of being wiped out or killed or anything else has any connection with the idea of what was going on in the evening news at the time? Like wars and battles and stuff like that?
You think, well, yeah.
That this is just a superimposition onto that?
Yeah, I see all that is linked.
You do see it as linked. And so I asked you before why you thought the avant-garde ended, and you said that it was because of the market. Can you explain that?
I said that there are a number of theories or factors. One of them is the market. But I also do believe in the legitimacy of what happened theoretically. I mean, these artists really were onto something. They really were doing something that was important and was called for by the art history of it all.
Okay. Where would you put the Museum of Modern Art's information show into that activity?
Well, that show was 1970, curated by Kynaston McShine. And, it was an important moment in the sense that the Museum of Modern Art acknowledged the reality of conceptual art.
Well, but it was also implying that information was exploding.
Yeah.
At a certain level, right? Would you agree with that, or is that not a correct assumption?
I think I would agree with that.
You would agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay, so if information was exploding, and the avant-garde is an implication, avant-garde just by what it means, is that you know it before anybody else knows it, or know it first, or whatever, you know, out in front, or whatever, doesn't that imply that there was no use for avant-garde anymore? Because information was so prevalent?
Well, but it seems to me, I see it in a very conventional way, which is that, our whole society became more conservative at that time. And so naturally, that type of art had to end. And there was a period of an attempt to revive a previous part of art. I'm sorry. I apologize.
It's okay.
I'm just going to turn it off. Do you see what I mean?
I do.
Yeah.
So your reference then to the market was the idea that because everything became more conservative, your word, that it was now necessary to be saleable as opposed to, let's say, provocative?
Well, I guess provocative no longer was saleable.
Go back to my thing a minute ago about the avant-garde. Is it also possible that a lot of the so-called hidden information which existed in the avant-garde was now public information or exposed?
That sounds reasonable. I don't know how much more time we have, but I came here to say two things to you people, not so much to you, Les, but and I've only said one of them. So if you'll give me a moment,
okay,
let me get on to my second point. My first point was about survival. Dennis was a great late modernist artist and a great postmodernist artist. I can't offhand think of anyone else who survived like that. I mean, maybe there are others. Anyway, let me get on to my second point, which has to do with the fact, you know, like I said, Dennis was 1 year older than me, and we both realized that we were old men. And that we were going to die before too long. And we talked about things, and we would get together and have serious conversations like about life and death and so on. And during one of these conversations, we were talking about a mutual friend an artist named Eric Orr, a great California artist, and Eric had recently died, and I was remarking to Dennis in this conversation, I said, Eric told me that he wasn't trying to be wise because he thought wisdom should be a quality of old age. And he was putting it off till he was old age. He wasn't going to worry about being wise yet. And anyway, Dennis made a reply, which I've never forgotten. Anyway, he said in a really serious tone, I mean, there wasn't anything joking about the tone, even a little undercurrent. And he said, well, you know, as for me, I don't think I ever have a chance of being wise, no matter how many lives I live. I think the most that I can hope for is to be good in my old age. Well, okay, that's all. That's what I came here tonight to tell you.
Okay. Anthony, can you come up? Can the next person take the chair then?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Great to see you all.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Can you move the chair in a direction there? Because we. Okay. Can you just move the chair so it's in the same position? Okay. So she's going to put that.
Put it under.
Thank you. Where do I put it? Under this?
Just this string under.
Thank you.
Okay, Anthony, do you want to make a statement of any sort to start with?
I'd like to make a comment, actually, on what we just heard. I mean, I have no argument with the narrative, but I do have a problem with some of the interpretation. To say that, you know, Julian Schnabel, the big specific, just robbed previous artists of meaning. I think it's like saying Cubists robbed Impressionists of meaning. I think those artists did what they did. They were the end of history, and then something else happened.
Which artists are you referring to?
Sorry?
Which artists are you referring to?
Well, the Neo-Expressionists and so forth, uh-huh. And whatever happened after that, the commodity artists and so forth. Something new happened. There's a lot of salon art around, and there's a lot of good art around, too. I think the modernists won. The Tate Modern is the third biggest tourist attraction in Britain. That art district in Beijing is the third biggest tourist attraction in China. So it's written, the avant-garde, is a French phrase meaning a small group of troops going ahead into hostile territory. Well, the territory ain't hostile any longer. And so, of course, the nature of art has greatly changed, not always for the better.
But why is that surprising? In any way.
Why does that?
I mean, why is that surprising in any way?
It doesn't surprise me at all.
Tiffany Glass is very brings crowds in, and anything that has sort of age on it, so to speak. Mm. You know, if you talk about art of 50 years ago, there are huge audiences for that kind of thing.
Yeah, but so, the avant-garde died in literature about 100 years ago. I mean, it almost died with T.S. Eliot, I think. It lasted an hour longer than that. It had a good long run, really.
Why do you think that is?
Well, if you look at Gertrude Stein and so forth, I mean, and Finnegan's Wake, I mean, that kind of deliberately unorthodox and, you know, that kind of writing's gone. I mean, it does not exist except in very tiny magazines.
Ah, I see. So you're thinking of the avant-garde being related to language specifically?
In that, no, I'm just saying that I think the various, you know, little adventures that those great artists went out, they were, they, they did their explorations. I mean, you can't get more monochrome than a monochrome. You can't, I mean, they reached a conclusion in many of their adventures. And the ones that were not concluded are still continuing, I suppose. I think they're continuing in other media quite often. They're continuing on the internet and so forth. But the ones in the graphic arts, all those explorations, I think, they've been explored.
Can we talk about this a little bit?
Sorry?
Can we talk about the lecture a little bit?
Yes.
Do you have any view of it?
I think it's brilliant. I love everything Dennis did. I'd prefer to talk about Dennis, actually.
Okay, go ahead.
I've never known a man who was at the same time more friendly and generous and laid back, and yet so ruthless in his critiques. And he was the most ruthless critic of the art world I've ever met. And not in a hostile, not in an ad hominem kind of way. But, you know, he would say things like, if you honestly gave 99 out of 100 of the artists out their truth serum and asked them, why do you make your work? They'd say, for money, was a real Dennis remark, you know, and probably an accurate one, as a matter of fact.
I don't think that's accurate.
Well, it has an element of truth in it.
I don't think so. I think that's a very sort of like suburban view of why artists make art.
I'm not supposed to say these things. Mm-hmm. Of course, we make it for other reasons, too.
Well, I mean, people make... Well, why don't they do other things where money is more easily made?
Well, nowadays, of course, nowadays it's become quite a profession.
I don't know.
I think he was talking about the new generation of artists.
Yeah, he was highly critical. I met him at the Museum of Modern Art at Bryce Martin's show, and he had some very critical things to say about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And they weren't lighthearted by any means.
Well, so one thing, Tom divided Dennis's career into two phases. I think it's actually divided into three phases. The third phase, I mean, Dennis was... ruthlessness as such. He hated dealing with dealers, as we all know. He hated dealing with institutions, which is probably why he never did have that retrospective. He was terrible at art politics, I think. He was wonderful on a personal level. And I think his third phase was when he went into public art, he and Jonathan Borofsky and a few other artists really, you know, kissed the art machinery goodbye and started making public art.
I'm calling that the second phase.
Sorry?
I'm calling that the second phase.
Oh. You don't think there's some kind of difference between the reindeer phase and the public phase?
No, I think there's a continuity of development from first to the second.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Okay. Well.
Apart from that, I had many conversations. Luckily, I actually recorded and transcribed a great many conversations with Dennis, and he was unfailingly acute and brilliant and perceptive. And I never had a talk with him from which I didn't learn something. I don't think I've got anything more to say, really. I miss him enormously.
Do you want to talk about this text here in any way?
About the lecture. I'll be totally honest. I've lost the hearing in my right ear.
And you didn't hear it.
I missed a lot of it. I'm sorry.
Well, the basis of it is that a series of artists have been killed or died in a very violent way.
Yeah.
And
is this fictional or?
Of course, it's fictional.
Yeah.
And Dennis sort of puts himself at a certain point as an observer of all this, and then eventually as a subject of some of it.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
As a narrative device.
No, not as a narrative device, as a person thinking that as something is ended, that that may be a form of death.
Yeah. Could you, I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand.
When something is ended, that it may be a form of death. Let's say, to take it away from this for a second, is divorce equivalent to death?
They say moving is a little death. They say lots of things are a little death, you know.
You're still alive, though. You've moved a few times.
Yes, I've had a lot of little deaths. I think, in fact, one thing that did, from what you say, that reminds me of the artists of Dennis' generation, maybe more in the UK than here, there was a strong element of science fiction, William Burroughs, that kind of thinking. There was a lot of progressive kind of radical futurism to that work, and I think it kind of, that narrative device partly reflects that, I think. But
William Burroughs one time said to me, never trust an honest man or a religious son of a bitch.
Mm. I would never trust an honest man if I ever met one.
Okay. Well, I'm interested, as you didn't hear this, it's sort of hard, but I'm interested in this choice of sort of approach. As opposed to somebody saying, let's say, the avant-garde is dead, these artists are no longer, let's say, have currency or whatever, but to take the approach of, let's say, simulating a violent sort of episode of one sort or another. What does that make you think of?
I think that was a metaphor. I doubt.
Obviously it was a metaphor, but why that metaphor?
Well, it's very inventive, it's very colourful, it's very gripping. That's all I can say to that, really. I think to understand the avant-garde, you have to read a book like The Masterpiece by Zola, and Zola clearly could not stand Cézanne, you know, and then you understand what it must be like, this cloud of universal unknowing that even radical writers had for radical art back then. And Cézanne grew up with Zola. I'm slightly dodging your question because I don't know the answer.
Okay. Hmm. Sorry. That was an answer. Is it possible and true that the avant-garde dying, or modernism dying, or postmodernism dying, which it has, is a necessity for the art world to continually reinvent some thing to be purchased at some level or another?
I think what we're seeing now is we're seeing two different art worlds. We're seeing the art world of Damien and Murakami, which is, you know, the world is flat, in which there's no, you know, there's all distinctions between fine art and design and CDs and whatsoever, but they're not very hierarchical. They all kind of slide into each other, and the world's still represented by people like William Kentridge, thank God, which is where art is very inner. It's made by one person, often without very, very many assistants, or any in the case of Kentridge. And that's a different kind of art world, and I think they both have their place.
Does John Curran fit into that?
John Curran has actually said to me once, he said, I don't think there's been an avant-garde moment in my lifetime. An avant-garde moment in my lifetime.
He's too young for that.
I know. I think it is probably quite avant-garde in its way now to deploy all those Beaux-Arts skills that no one else much has anymore. You know, I think to survive those skills is quite something anyway. These days, and Lisa Yuksovich also, and Mike Cockerell, but very few artists can paint and draw that way anymore. Not in the West, anyway.
But it does fit a very conservative model of what art should be.
I just think art has become so huge that, you know, we still think that historically there's a little, you know, a bunch of 50 or 60 cubists in Paris, and very shortly, they sort out who the four or five are going to last. And now I think, the art world is giant, and there are a giant number of artists. Inevitably, there'll be a much larger number of good artists, and inevitably, a lot of those are going to be overlooked. So maybe that's the new avant-garde. Basically, it's the overlooked artists.
Okay. The overlooked artist. In terms of Dennis's, so-called public art, you know, there's always this idea that public art should be lasting, like you have a monument of, let's say, Washington somewhere that's supposed to be there forever. Do you see that kind of art lasting forever?
I don't think we, in our generation, even someone as old as me, I don't think we think of posterity or the future in the way that the previous generations did. I think everybody thinks art is, we live in an eternal now. I mean, Facebook induces an eternal present. Everything's bright and type always looks fresh, and people who died long ago, look, when I look at my address book and my laptop, it looks like they're still there, you know. I don't think we think about the future as people used to. I'm sure of it.
I see. We don't think about the future?
No. I think we realize the future's not like, it's likely to be short and a bit grim, as a matter of fact.
Uh-huh. I see. Do you think that of course, you didn't hear it, so it's hard for me to ask you.
The Reverend
what
said
would your, what would your version of 1968 avant-garde artists be? What would your list be? Seeing as you probably made a lot of lists of a lot of things during your lifetime.
It's very hard to think. You know, somebody said to me, Ronnie Cotrone, he said, there's no hangouts anymore. I mean, where's that? There's nowhere that, as far as I know, I could suddenly think, oh, it's 8 o'clock, I'm not doing anything. I'll go along and I'll see some people I know, probably see some. And they used to be, they've all gone. I think maybe that's going on in Williamsburg and Bushwick, you know, but it's sure not going on in Manhattan.
Okay. Did you want to say anything else about Dennis or this?
Tom, I agree with profoundly that Dennis is extraordinarily highly regarded, but still under-regarded, as a matter of fact. I feel the same about Rauschenberg, oddly enough. I think that huge artists who are still hugely underestimated.
Well, Dennis he told me on several occasions that he felt the art world didn't care for his public works.
He said that the art world was
didn't care for his public works. Uh-huh. That he felt somehow that in doing the public works he was alienating himself from the art world.
It's interesting. I've never heard anybody say that doing public work is a negative. As a matter of fact, if it's good work.
No, I'm saying he said it. Not.
Yeah. I understand. I think his public work is extraordinary in that it both works thoroughly as art, and yet, you know, people walk by it and enjoy it, you know, and maybe some institutions didn't like the idea of him doing public art, but I've never heard that from anybody.
Okay, well, you've heard it now.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Did you want to say anything else? Does anybody else...
Let him have that retrospective, is what I say.
Does somebody else want to come up and take the chair? Mm. How about you, Roger? You want to come up? Roger, come on up. Did you hear this lecture?
Yeah, well, I got it a little late, but...
But did you hear it in its original form?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you're talking about the piece. Yeah. Actually, I thought that the whole idea of a lecture, and then not having a lecture, but telling a story, and telling the story of artists being murdered was, he liked to play with irony a lot. And I kind of thought that was another one of these ironical pieces. An empty lecture room. As a matter of fact, it looked a little like this. But
What's the irony involved?
The irony was that it wasn't a lecture in the sense that it was like more like a warning, like telling people a story.
It was an anti-lecture.
Yeah, it was kind of an anti-lecture. It was like, well, you better be careful because you're going to get, I don't know who's next, and I might be next, and that
but
kind
do
of
you,
thing.
Do you think in any way, seeing as you mentioned irony, and irony, it seems to me, was a big aspect of the avant-garde. And irony sort of became a very unpleasant idea in art when the avant-garde died. People started to stop liking irony.
Really?
When? I think so.
Gee.
I think irony was not all that usable after the avant-garde.
Mm. Irony went out of style.
It went out with the avant-garde, yeah. That was... What do you think about that?
Well, if you're going to have a sense of humor in the work at all, And because it's a visual media and you're going to have visual takes on it and ideas bouncing off from it, it would seem that it would be difficult to eliminate irony if you're going to have any sense of humor.
No, you can have a sense of humor without irony. Irony is just one ploy.
I suppose. You had mentioned something a little earlier about other things that were going on at the time, like what would make him reevaluate, what made Dennis reevaluate the work, and that there were multiple things, perhaps, not just one. And I kind of felt that there were a lot of ideas, but it was just a formal shift. I mean, I don't think that he dropped all of his ideas or other ideas or thought that that work wasn't up to par. And I don't know about the other artists. It was something about the fact that you switched medias that was a difficult thing to do, because if you did switch medias a lot, then the whole idea of identifying with a particular image or type of image went out, which could undermine your position.
Could you see this piece as just simply being a piece of sculpture, an environmental room with a taped lecture and chairs, as being simply an installation work without irony?
You mean without the voice? There was no sound?
No, with the voice, just it being an installation piece.
Yeah, although I thought the voice was, the story was part of it.
So did I. I'm including that as part of the concept, a soundtrack in the room. There are many installation pieces that have a soundtrack in the room.
Right. I guess I'm not getting your question.
Well, that it's just an installation work, and that's it.
Yeah, it's an installation work. You're right.
Take that approach.
Yeah, surely.
And so, what do you, apart from the most obvious sort of like literal concept, what do you think it's about in his mind? I mean, why choose that way of dealing with that subject?
Well, there were a lot of colleges and universities and so forth that were picking up. I mean, I did a lot of lectures. I'm sure you did a lot of
exactly.
lectures. Exactly. And you went around to all these schools, and of course, everybody always wanted to figure out some way to make it different. Uh-huh. Right. And I think that it was a little bit of a commentary on that, and of course about the artist being a performer. Uh-huh. Okay, you get up, you're going to make a little talk about your work, and so this was a case where he's saying, well, no, I'm going to talk about death, or the death of making an artwork, or the death of an artist.
Or, I agree with what you said. There were a lot of lectures. Everybody expected you, even though you were an artist, to be a very good lecturer. You had to lecture all over the place. Is it possible that all this death and destruction was a way of saying, I'm taking lectures away from you? Audience, you're going to be deprived of lectures?
I go back to the ironical thing of the whole idea that making a lecture as an artwork. It's like, okay, you go to a school and you're sitting, and that's not an artwork, you're talking about artwork. So you look at it and you say, okay, I'm just going to make this lecture an artwork by itself. And I'm going to change myself into this little puppet, or puppeteer, or not, I mean a puppet. I mean, I go back to the title, like, lecture. It just seemed, it had humor to it, obviously.
Yeah, but lecture is not a very humorous thing. The word lecture,
itself. No, it's not humorous at all.
I mean, it sounds like somebody's, and part of the reason we're talking like this is because we don't want it to be a lecture, okay? We don't want to be talking at people.
Right.
But let me ask you this question, and maybe we'll come to an end with this. If artworks are sort of a representation of the person who makes them, what do you think this represents about Dennis?
Well, actually, this feeds into our next panel here. But if we can just stay right here.
Okay.
I think that it had to do with the fact that he didn't want to be, he wanted to always be sort of pushing some kind of boundary. There's always the idea that there's another boundary to cross, another, and when it got to a certain point where you go to places, you're the artist, you go to a show, you have a show, you have this, you keep having shows and lectures and this, and eventually you feel like other people are pulling the strings and you're just dancing to whatever tune that they want. And I think that lack of autonomy, or the idea that there was a lack of autonomy, was a big source of this idea from the very beginning. And also not, you know, using himself as the artist that's going to be the little facsimile to represent himself, but represent all any artist. I think that was, but himself in particular, and that's what I thought.
Now, what does it say about himself, as you put it? Is it yourself that's in it? What does it say about himself?
I think it's addressing artists. It's addressing the dilemma of...
No, but it does say something about him.
He probably was more involved in running around doing performances than a lot of people. And it probably hit him more. I can only guess about that. It's motivation. It's his motivation. I mean, he had the motivation. I think it's kind of interesting that very few, up until Catalan recently, have used themselves in sort of a mini-me kind of way. And
What do you mean by that?
Like a surrogate of himself. But this little miniature puppet, I don't know anybody else that did that. I don't remember anybody else doing that.
Really?
Yeah, who?
Gee, do you want me to give you the list is extensive.
Of little puppets on a string.
Not of puppets, but of people making portraits of themselves and putting it into their work.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about portraits themselves. I'm talking about a little puppet which has its own interpretations right away because it's a little puppet.
Uh-huh.
That's the difference.
Uh-huh.
I think.
Okay, that's a good point well made. That's a good point.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.